Welcome to another installment of New Books in Military History. I'm your host, Jay Lockenauer, and with me today is Matthias Strohn, whose new book, The German Army and the Defense of the Reich, Military Doctrine and the Conduct of Defensive Battle, 1918 to 1939, just appeared with Cambridge University Press. I first met Matthias in the German military archive in Freiburg in 2006, where he was putting the finishing touches on the dissertation that would become this book. And he impressed me as an energetic young scholar who was eager to revise our understanding of German interwar military doctrine. Historians for a long time have focused on finding the roots of Blitzkrieg in the interwar period, Blitzkrieg being the lightning war that the Germans practiced in 1939 and 40 that enabled such spectacular victories over Belgium and in particular France. Strohn was proceeding from the sensible point of view that the small German Reichswehr, the 100,000-man army that was allowed the Germans by the Treaty of Versailles, it was a fantasy for the Germans in the interwar period to really think about offensive warfare. Their army was dwarfed by all of their neighbors, even the Belgians, and they couldn't even hope to match the Poles or the Czechs, and certainly not the French. And so thinking about defensive warfare was just a fact of life for the Germans. It was really all that they could hope practically to do. Offensive doctrine, as Strohn tries to argue, was at least secondary to their thinking. So it's one of the reasons I wanted to feature his work on New Books in Military History once it appeared, because I think it's likely to reignite a conversation about interwar doctrine. Strohn is currently an instructor at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst in the UK, and I think you'll enjoy the conversation I was able to have with him. With me today is Matthias Strohn, the author of The German Army and the Defense of the Reich, Military Doctrine and the Conduct of Defensive Battle, 1918 to 1939, published by Cambridge University Press just in the last year. Welcome to New Books in Military History, Matthias.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to rekindle this acquaintance that we made in the German archives several years ago, and happy to see that the project that you're working on is now between covers.
Yeah, finally. It took a while.
As it does. Well, we like to have the authors introduce themselves to our audience, so if you'd tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Mm-hmm. My name's Matthias Strohn. I was born in 1976 in Germany. After school, I did my military service, as we all had to do in Germany, because in those days we still had conscription. I then did my officer training. After that, then went to university. Started at the University of Münster back in Germany for the simple reason that in those days that was the only university in Germany that had a chair in military history. Then in 2001, I came over to England and did a master's degree at Oxford University, and then decided to stay there to do the DPhil, so the doctorate. And in 2005, I worked for the British Staff College for a while, and in 2006, I got the job at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, and that's where I still work today. The idea for this book was born a long, long time ago, and I remember I was on a seminar, and we went to Berlin, and I had to give a presentation on the German army in the interwar period. It was a seminar about total war. And as I said, I gave a paper on Hans von Sieg, and that's basically how it all started, and that's what woke my interest in the subject. And so I also chose Hans von Sieg for my master's thesis. And then I thought after that, it's time to leave the interwar period behind and to go into the Second World War. And I had agreed on a title for my dissertation with my supervisor, Hugh Strohn, at Oxford. And I wanted to look at the end of the Second World War. We both agreed that to do that, you need to look at the interwar period again, just to see what kind of ideas the German army developed in the interwar period, and whether all these tactical and operational thoughts and innovations that they came up with in the Second World War were actually completely new or just a development from the First World War, the interwar period, or perhaps even, well, a different period. So I went to the German archives in Freiburg, and so when I looked through all the documents and for the interwar period, I saw there was so much material there that hadn't been used and accessed by any historians, and the material that had been used had only been used in a very, very narrow field. And that was basically the common argument trying to prove that the German army had developed some sort of a blitzkrieg tactic or doctrine in the interwar period that it then put to the test in 1939. When I looked through the material, I relatively quickly realized that the story was much more complicated and complex. And so I went back to Oxford and I talked to Hugh Strawn, and so we both agreed that actually it would be quite a good idea to change the topic of the dissertation and to have a look at the interwar period in much more depth and detail. Because as I said, no one had actually ever done this before. Whenever you find articles and books on the interwar period, all they're trying to prove is really that, as I said, the German army had this concept of a blitzkrieg, and so that was developed in the interwar period and then put to the test in 1939.
This is a sort of an irony, or at least a coincidence, that my most recent interview was with Robert Cetino about his book, Death of the Wehrmacht. So this will form a sort of a nice pairing, because in a way, I mean, you're an admirer. It comes out in the footnotes, I think, of Cetino's work and Coram's work. But what is it that they're missing, or how do you modify their thesis in your work?
The problem that I found with most authors is when they look at the interwar period, they only see that as a period of transition. So they approach it from the Second World War, that's their angle, and they think, where did they get all their ideas from? And then they move back into the interwar period, and then they move back into the First World War. And the common theme, the common argument that people like Cetino have brought forward is that particular development of the stormtroopers in the First World War basically sets the scene. Then once they've lost the war, they then use the next 20 or so years they have in the interwar period to basically think through the ideas, to come up with new ideas, to bring in the tanks, to bring in the Air Force, and then put the whole thing to the test in 1939. But it really, the problem really is that basically the argument starts in 1939 up to 1941, when they have this developed blitzkrieg concept. When you actually do look at the sources, yes, of course, well, there are some aspects there that you might say, okay, then become, well, the blitzkrieg and the blitzkrieg tactic. But when you actually look at what the German army did, particularly the general staff, even though, well, they were not called the general staff anymore, because, well, German army was not allowed to have a general staff, so the Truppenamt and other institutions, when you look at the problems they dealt with and the solutions they came up with, basically it's all about a defensive war, mainly against Poland and also France. And that's what they do from 1918 basically up to 1938, some even up to 1939. It is pretty much about a defensive war, mainly against Poland, because they realized that for the majority of the interwar period, if France gets involved in a major new war with Germany, the German army will lose within a few weeks' time. So, yes, well, there are some aspects, there are some ideas that you might say link in with the Blitzkrieg doctrine and the Blitzkrieg idea. But when you actually, when you do dig a bit deeper, you do see that most of these ideas and principles are not really anything new. They really link in with what happened in the First World War, and you can, well, go back even further in history. For example, the German manual of 1906, the infantry manual, states a lot of these things that we then see in the Second World War. The big difference between the First World War and even the years before the First World War and then the Second World War is not so much that the doctrine changes, but what you do have, of course, is now you've got the combustion engine, and that's used to a much wider degree and effect than, for example, in the First World War. And the effect of that is, of course, increased by the fact that particularly the French in the Second World War want to refight the First World War. So they have an army which is very much structured to a 1914 to 18 conflict. So the artillery, for example, is very, very strong. The tanks, even though they are very good, they're also very slow because they're still mainly seen as an infantry support weapon. And they're not used in that role that the Germans use them. So the French and the other armies have got the same machines at their disposal, but they use them differently. And when you look at what the Germans actually do in 1939, 1940, the principles, you might say, are not really new. The principles were tried and tested even in the First World War when the Germans invaded France. They are pretty much the same. Only everything happens much quicker on the battlefield because now they can put people on lorries in tanks and they have the air force. And so things on the battlefield happen quicker. That means the absolute speed of, well, potentially both armies go up. But of course, since particularly the French want to refight the First World War, actually they slow themselves down. And that it's this gap which then gives the Germans the upper hand. But as I said, when you look at the doctrine of the interwar period, most of it really goes back to, well, tried and tested sound German military doctrine and principles. And the application of these principles, as I said earlier, in the interwar period is very much limited to a defensive war, which of course does not mean that you're not acting offensively. This is now linking in with Clausewitz's statement about the nature of defense. So there is not a defense which is 100% defensive. You need to have offensive action as well. But the overall conduct of operations will be defensive. And the Germans realize that because simply they'd be utterly outnumbered. And when you look at some of these statements, particularly from the later part of the Weimar Republic, so between, let's say, 1930, 1933, sometimes even up into the first year of the Nazi period, up to 35, 36, they are pretty clear about that. And they realize that even if Poland declared war on Germany, that the German army would not stand a chance in the field of battle. And so when you then look at the French army, that is several hundred thousand strong, with lots of tanks and a massive artillery, and the Germans don't have anything of that, and they've got what is basically a police force of 100,000 men, they quickly realized that the only thing they could do was withdraw into central Germany and then stand, fight, and die somewhere. And that is pretty much what they discuss most of the time. Where shall we actually meet the French in battle, and where shall we die?
Yeah, that's an interesting. There's a sort of a cultural angle to this, I think, which could of course fill an extra volume about these attitudes about national honor and especially with the sting of the Versailles Treaty and the Ruhr occupation and so forth. You've brought up several issues in this introduction already that I wanted to talk about. I think it's fascinating that even in a book about the German army and the defense of the Reich, you know, how much you do end up talking about this kind of offensive mindedness of the Germans as being a part of the German tradition to attack the enemy where you find him. And yet to combine that in with your thesis about the overall I'll use the word strategy, and I'm probably using it incorrectly, but the overall tendency to be defensive. So can you who were the people that were involved in squaring that circle, or what were the different theories? I mean, you talk about this transition, especially between Seeckt and a kind of post-Seeckt, whether it's Beck or Stulpnagel. Can you describe that in a little bit more detail, especially about Seeckt, since you've done so much work on him?
Mm-hmm. This whole debate sets in very, very early on, even before the peace treaty of Versailles is signed. So there are a number of meetings after the armistice where German politicians ask the view of the military, and they want to see whether it might be possible not to sign the treaty and go back to war. And it's already here. It's late 1918, early 1919, where you can see the entire development of the interwar period. There's the one group of officers who say, whatever happens now, we have to go to war again, because it is all about, as you said earlier, it's all about the honor. Even if Germany dies, it doesn't really matter. It's all about the honor, and that will then enable us to have a big reborn Germany in 20 years' time. And these people, like Walter Reinhardt, for example, the first head of the army command, so Erster Chef der Heeresleitung, he was pretty clear about that. And he said, let's not sign a peace treaty. Let's fight again. Let's take up arms. He knew that that would result in the invasion of Germany, particularly by the French army. He was willing to accept that. He was willing to accept the breakup of the German Reich. And he said, we'll go into East Prussia and we'll fight them from there. So that was the one league, or the one group of people. Then you have other people who are a bit more, the territoriality, you might say. And so one of them is Wilhelm Groener, for example. And he then briefs the politicians and also a lot of military people. And he says, yes, well, we can do that. That's absolutely no problem. But, of course, that means we will die. And for us, the most important thing now is that we keep the unity of the Reich. We have to keep Germany together. And then in 10, 15, 20 years' time, once we've regained a little bit of strength, then we can unleash another big war. He was pretty clear about that he wanted another war. Relatively often, when you hear about him, people say, "Well, yeah, he was one of the nicer ones. He wanted peace." Not really. He also wanted to go to war. He wanted to win the eastern territories back, but he realized that with the army at hand and in the international situation, that could not be achieved. So that's how it roughly sets out. And then, from a more military perspective, you then have a number of interesting developments. Because first of all, you mentioned Siegt, Hans von Siegt, second Chef der Heeresleitung, and basically probably the most important man in the interwar period for the German army. He was so important that he's been called the creator of the Reichswehr. And the principles he set out and that were embodied in the manual Führung und Gefecht der verbundenen Waffen, which was introduced in the early 1920s. Some of his ideas quite well. And again, here you can see interesting development, because when people have looked at Siegt, most people have only looked at this transition towards Blitzkrieg. And yes, it is there. So he likes offensive operations. He thinks that the German army should be a relatively small army. He's not quite clear about the numbers. So sometimes he says somewhere in the region of 200,000 men. Then he goes up to about 400,000 men. But that's about it. He does not want to go back to the mass army of the First World War. He wants to have a professional army that is well-equipped and that can be sent into battle without any time of mobilization. So because he thinks that would give the German army the upper hand in a war, for example, against France. Before the French would be able to mobilize their 80, 90 divisions and hundreds of thousands of soldiers, the German army, in a perfect scenario, would already have conquered Paris. That's the big idea sets out. So yes, he's very much about offensive warfare.
And it's supplemented by he has a concept for a militia. Is that fair to say? That's then going to follow up. I mean, he doesn't imagine that 200,000 men are ultimately going to conquer Europe. Is that true?
When in his writings, Siegt is relatively clear about his concept for what he calls the operating army, the Operationsarmee, which is the professional part of the army. He lays it out quite well. He talks about it in the number of books he writes. And when you look at his manual Führung und Gefecht der verbundenen Waffen, it is pretty obvious and clear that was written with this kind of operating army in mind. The second part of his concept, that deals with the militia. And when you look at the militia and the concepts he develops there, all his ideas are not as well thought through as they are with the operating army. And he changes his ideas a number of times. For example, in one of his books, he says that the military should be responsible for training the militia. Then in another book, he says that it shouldn't be the military, but it should be civilian organizations. That also has to do with the context. As well, it's pretty obvious and clear that after 1933, there's a bit of a break when suddenly he sees that, yes, well, the Nazis have come to power. They've got this idea of, the people, and you can bring in many more agencies than before. So that's the one break we have. On the other hand, it is quite interesting to see that Siegt, in his writings, as I said earlier, is very much in favor of offensive warfare. So he wants to, if possible, he wants to invade the enemy territory before the enemy can invade Germany. That's why he wants to have this mobile army, this army that is professional, well-equipped, that does not have or does not need any time for mobilization. So the second war is declared, Germany can then invade the other countries. If you do it like that, you don't even need the militia. Because the aim of the militia, the main aim of the militia is, and he says this in his writings, is to defend Germany against an invader. So here you can see a bit of a disconnect between, in his arguments, because what do you need the militia for if you invade the enemy in the first place? On the other hand, he then gets around to it and says, we still need reinforcements for the army. So these reinforcements basically come from the militia. The militia is some sort of, half trained bunch of people. So at least they've seen a rifle before. They know how to shoot. They've had some, well, military experience perhaps. So these guys can then be brought into the proper army and can then be brought up to speed relatively quickly. So you can see that whereas the idea about the operating army, the offensive part of the war, is very, very much thought through. With him, it's not so much when you look at the defensive part. And that's, I think, is also one of the reasons why most other historians have looked at Zieg and said, he's been so influential, he's been very important, because when you look at his concepts, you can clearly see that some of the stuff, if you want to make that connection well, then lead to Blitzkrieg.
And he cooperates. He sets up the cooperation with the Soviet Union, right, where they're supposed to be experimenting with forbidden weapons. It does look pretty promising.
Exactly. Well, there's a few things there. That's absolutely right. On the other hand, and that's the interesting things, when you go into the archives and you look at the sources, you find relatively quickly that an awful lot of officers did not agree with what Zieg had to say. And that's another thing that many people often overlook. When you have this idea of the Blitzkrieg, you always get the idea that, people all subscribed to it and they thought that's the way forward, but actually it wasn't. And there's a number of statements by people like Joachim von Stultnagel or Grünauer again that say that, it's a nice idea. We might be able to do something like that in the next, 15, 20, 30, 40 years' time, but actually it doesn't help us at all now. And that is the problem. The big eye-opener is the occupation of the Ruhr area in 1923. So in 1922, Germany falls behind with a payment of reparation, and this is then taken as the lever by the French and the Belgians to occupy the Ruhr area, the industrial heartland of Germany. This has, very, very severe impacts on German economy, and that's one of the reasons why we then have the hyperinflation of 1923 in Germany. And it is fair to say that that actually has left a mark on the German general conscience. And basically, whenever you talk to Germans and you talk about monetary issues, the one thing they don't want is inflation. Because, even in the 1920s, what they experienced there is still very much there in the common knowledge. It also had a big impact on the military scene. Young people like Joachim von Stulpnagel started publicly criticizing Hans von Zieg and said, the ideas he's developed might be quite good if we ever, get a good army of about 400,000 men and it's well equipped, but we don't have this army now. So what can we do now to defend Germany against the enemy? And they're crystal clear about the fact because, they've just seen that Germany is not able to fight against the French, let alone invade France or even Poland. And they form what some people have called the so-called Front. So basically, it's a group of young officers in the Ministry of Defense, in the Truppenamt, i.e. the General Staff, who come up with new ideas. And probably the most famous one, and quite a lot of stuff has been written on him, is Joachim von Stulpnagel and his idea about the People's War. So he says, he gives a number of talks in 1924 and also 25, where he writes about talks about the current situation, says, how can we actually win a war if it comes to war? And he says, the only thing we can do is, we can have some sort of guerrilla war, which, of course, is nothing really that Germans are very fond of, because Germans just don't do these things. You want to fight, in the open, like a proper soldier. But he says it's the only thing we can do. There's nothing else, because the army is just too weak. So you can see there's a lot of intellectual debate in the Truppenamt. And the interesting thing is that Stulpnagel writes that in his unpublished memoirs. He says that Zieg didn't like the idea at all. Zieg is relatively often praised for his open-mindedness. And so when you read particularly the secondary literature, it relatively often says that was one of the strengths of the German army. The German army in the 1920s and 30s had all these theoretical ideas. They were allowed to think, to come with new stuff, new ideas, and then basically practice them. That was not so much the case with Stulpnagel. And Stulpnagel writes in his memoirs that Zieg wanted him removed from the Truppenamt. He had a relatively important position there in the operations section, because he simply didn't like Stulpnagel's ideas. And it was only because the defense minister and a few other people intervened that he was actually allowed to stay. Not for very long, because in the end, Zieg got his way and had him removed. So again, you can see, the whole story is a bit more complex and complicated than many people think. And Zieg managed to hang on for another 3 years. He was then sacked in 1926. The reasons for that were actually a bit trivial. He didn't really get on well with the defense minister, Gessler, because simply didn't take him seriously. That's another interesting point. When you talk about the German army in the interwar period, relatively often people say that that was the state within the state. It was a statement brought forward by the socialist newspaper Vorwärts, I think, already in 1919 or 1920. When you actually do look at the structure of the state and the position of the army within the state, you can see that the politicians had actually thought that one through. And it was pretty clear that the politicians, at least officially, were in charge. Because it was always the Reichspräsident, the president of the Reich, and then the defense minister who would have the last say over the generals. But under Sieg, because Sieg was such a strong figure, and Gessler, the defense minister, was not, the situation changed. And the army then became more powerful than probably it should have been. This then changed later on again when Ebert dies in 1926, and we have the new president. Of course, the new president, Hindenburg, is not only the president, but what you might say is far more important to the generals. He's also the field marshal of the First World War. So suddenly Sieg is in a rather uncomfortable position that he now has to take orders from the Reich president, who gets his authority within the army, not because of being Reich president, but because of being field marshal. So, and you can really see that, his position weakens after 1925. And in 1926, he's then sacked simply because he allowed a member of the royal family to take part in some, field exercises. And that was then taken by the politicians as a lever to sack him. And it is quite interesting to see that most of the, at least the younger officers, were not, didn't feel too sorry about that. And they were quite glad to see him leave, to be perfectly honest. Because, they, as I said earlier, had realized that Sieg's ideas did not offer any solutions to the current problems Germany was facing in the military sphere. And after that, all these new concepts found more attention, were given more attention, even though Stülpnagel and his idea of the People's War did not really win too many supporters. He had a few, and there were a few war games and exercises where they tested that, but it was then relatively quickly realized that this whole concept, it did offer some value, but the political implications of this were just too great, and if the Allies found out about that, that would have an awful lot of negative implications. So they set up what they called the Feldjägerdienst, which is a bit misleading to many people, particularly those who do speak a little bit of German and are familiar with German military terminology. Normally, a Feldjäger in current German military terminology is a member of the military police. So might cause some confusions. But in those days, this Feldjägerdienst, basically these were the guerrillas. And the idea was to have an army of around about 200,000 to 300,000 men in Germany alone who could be mobilized at any moment. They also wanted to push out into what they call the occupied territories. So that is Alsace-Lorraine and, of course, particularly in the east in Poland, and prepare people for, the next big war. As I said, it never really kicked off. They had some support in Germany, but the organization outside Germany never really worked. And when they then finally abolished the whole system in the mid to late 1920s, they have about 10,000 people ready. And after the so-called Gessler Sievering Treaty between the Minister of Defense and the Prussian Minister of the Interior, they then stopped the whole thing. Because they say that, we do have 10,000 people, but the political implications of this could be so severe that it's simply not worth pursuing that. Nevertheless, it is interesting to see that the whole idea was then taken up again several years later, and that's towards the end of the Second World War. This whole concept of the Wehrwolf, this partisan movement within Germany, where you would fight against the invading enemies, was actually then taken by a chap called Adolf Prutzmann, who was at that stage in the SS and in the 1920s, had actually worked on that Feldjäger pamphlet. He took it up again, and so this Werwolf concept of the Second World War is actually based on, you might say in essence, on Stülpnagel's ideas from the 1920s.
Well, that was exactly what I was going to ask. That you highlighted this continuity of personnel, that the people that were involved in 1944, 45 were in at the beginning in the 20s. And one of the things one of the possibilities that your book opens up, I think, is to trace some of those personal connections, the degrees of patronage and sort of client patron relations that go on. We know the story fairly well, I think, from the First World War with Moltke and Ludendorff and versus Falkenhayn and with Hindenburg and the Third Supreme Command and so forth. And it's no surprise, as you point out, that these same kinds of things go on with Seicht has his coterie and Stulpnagel is on the outside and so forth. It's a really interesting kind of institutional study as well.
That's very true. And one thing we shouldn't overlook is the German army at that time is very, very small. It's 100,000 people. That really isn't a lot. So I can see it here in England, where the British army is about more or less about the same size as the Reichswehr used to be. And it's just astonishing to see, well, after a few years having worked for the army, basically you know the entire army officer corps. And it's just that's the way it was in the Reichswehr as well. And then, of course, another thing we have to remember is that all these decisions and these tensions we talk about here, they did not really affect the average company commander. So this really is, you might say, the operational thinking, the strategic thinking that takes place in the Ministry of Defense and takes place in the Truppenamt, i.e. in the General Staff. So this really is just a handful of soldiers who make all these decisions, who think about these things, who write things up. So it really is a very, very small circle.
And but it's a worthwhile revision, though, because of a common sense sort of approach to it, which has been that Seicht in particular was able to select, mainly staff officers and so forth to tailor the Reichswehr to his vision. But you point out how he wasn't entirely able to do that, even with such a small core of an army.
Well, he's important when they set up the Reichswehr. He gets a say there. There is a big debate within the German army in 1918, early 1919, up to 1920, about which soldiers, which officers in particular, should actually be taken over into the Reichswehr. And so there's two different camps here. And the one camp says, well, it should be the infantry officer who's actually seen service in the trenches, so who knows what combat is like. So these guys, we'll be needing them because they are the war heroes. Let's take these guys into the army. Seicht then says, well, no, that's no good. Because we do need general staff officers because it's all about thinking. The thinking part is more important. You can always train soldiers relatively easily and also officers, but it's all about intellectual abilities. And he then points out that at least in theory, and that was, of course, the German general staff idea and the structure, that even general staff officers were normal frontline officers. As well, normally they would move from a staff appointment to a troops command somewhere on the Western Front or wherever. And he gets to say, so the Reichswehr consists of a large number of general staff officers taken over from the First World War. And another thing that is quite striking also consists of a very, very high percentage of aristocracy. During the Weimar Republic, the German army has the highest percentage of aristocracy that it ever has. And Seicht is quite clear about that. He wants these people in there. He doesn't want anybody else. And you can also see that early 1920s, when the question comes up what to do with the Freikorps. There are some people who say we should take over all these units because, well, they fought quite well and they can fight. And he says, no, I don't want any of this riffraff in my army because they're not used to a normal chain of command. Most of them only obey their free corps leader, and we don't want them in there. So they do take them over, particularly in the temporary Reichswehr in 1920. But then they're trying to get them out again. And he's quite successful at that. But yes, it is a very interesting point because the army is small. And when you look at all the big German military heroes of the Second World War, of course, you see all the names in the interwar period. All of these people then make general and field marshal in the Second World War, of course, were there in the Reichswehr as well. And you do see all the names. And the interesting thing really is that a high percentage of the great generals, let's call them, of the Second World War, were actually part of this younger group who did not particularly like Zeke's ideas. So, for example, in the Stülpnagel group, you have people like Fritz Blomberg and the like. So there's an interesting mix of people there. Other people, on the other hand, like Guderian, I think were not as important as they're later made out to be because simply he was too young. Yes, he did write a few articles, and yes, he did look at British and French and American tank doctrine, but there are other people who perhaps were a bit more important than Guderian at the time.
You mentioned the Ruhr occupation of 1923 as an important watershed. Is this, quote, seizure of power by the Nazis in 1933 the next important watershed?
The interesting thing is that from a military perspective, as the direct implications the seizure of power had for, well, a possible conduct of war, it wasn't that important at all. Hitler developed his ideas of, well, gaining the living space in the East, and he told this to the heads of the military relatively early on. But it did not mean that the military situation had changed considerably. You might say from a military point of view, actually the thing that is more important is perhaps the treaty Germany signs with Poland in 1934. Because suddenly for the first time, Germany does not have to expect a Polish invasion in the next war. That has always been the big fear. So they always thought it doesn't matter what happens. If war breaks out, Poland and France will eventually together invade Germany, and that's the end of Germany as we know it. So 1933 does not really change anything. When you look at the war games, the exercises, they are still pretty much the same. Simply because, yes, they have these ideas. Yes, they want to build a strong army. But in 1933, they don't have it. And even then later on, when the German army gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and, well, it's quite impressive to see how quick they managed to do that, actually. So they moved from an army from just over 100,000 men in 1933 to 2.5 million in 1939. But they had to cut a lot of corners. Germans did not think that the army was as good as it looked on paper. And the other thing, and that's relatively overlooked, is the fact that all the other armies around Germany, or the other countries, still had pretty large armies. So the French army still stood at roughly 800,000 men. And if you expect a major European war, and you expect that in that war you will have to fight against Poland, France, and probably Czechoslovakia, and perhaps even, well, the Soviet Union, or, well, even another state, 2 million German soldiers are actually not that many. And it's quite interesting to see that in most of the plans and the exercise and the war games from the German military, right up to 1938-1939, they're still very much planning on a defensive war. And it's only in the late 1930s that they actually say that we've now got this army which is relatively big, and now we can actually defend Germany against the enemy. They're not really talking about launching big invasions into France, because they still think that the French army is far superior to the German army, and that if a big war breaks out, yes, they will be able to hold the French back now. They will be able to defend the River Rhine and the Black Forest in the south, but they think that they're still not strong enough to launch a big invasion. There are, for example, a few documents from the later Field Marshal Leeb, who is at that stage Army Group Commander C, and he writes letters and pamphlets back to Berlin saying that, well, it's still so dire, so if war really does break out, we can't do anything and we will lose. And he lists the French units and the German units facing each other. And actually, it's quite impressive because you can see that for the German army in the West, the situation was not that good at all. So yes, it's getting better, but in 1939, the Germans did not think that they had this big army that was able to launch, well, what we now call Blitzkrieg, and basically subdue most of Europe within the next 2 or 3 years' time. So that came as a big surprise to the German army as well. I think, as we all know, and of course, where we have these debates between Hitler and his generals. And the reason why we have them is exactly because the generals had the experience of the interwar period. So you have a small army, you're surrounded by strong enemies. What can you actually do to defend Germany against the enemy? And I think this is one of the core points about the book. As I said earlier, normally the period between the two world wars is just reduced to this period of transition. And people tend to overlook what the people in those years actually thought and did and what they wanted to achieve. Of course, they did not know that in 1939 they'd have a big army and could launch a big war. And in 1945, of course, well, the story would take a different ending. They did not know that in the 1920s and in the early 1930s. And they had to come up with plans for the defense of Germany at the time and not do some crystal ball glazing and say, okay, in 10, 15 years' time, we might have an army which looks like this.
I mean, the remarkable thing, as you're pointing out, is that even into 1939, this issue hasn't been settled about what the army can do to be victorious.
Yes, that's very true. And of course, it's particularly an issue in the West at this stage. By 1939, the German army is quite sure that it can win a war against Poland. And, well, interesting enough, the Germans, for most of the time, they're quite sure about that. Up to 1923, 26, they say, yes, well, Poland is not an issue. We can defeat Poland. That's all doable. Then we have the Ruhr occupation. They think, yeah, maybe it's all a bit more complicated. But then by the mid-1930s, and where they get a bit more confident because the army is getting bigger, and they say, yes, Poland, we can deal with Poland. That's not the problem. The problem always remains France, because they know that whatever happens in the east, eventually France will come in and support Germany's enemies. So really the problem for the Germans is the Western Front, not the east. As Gruner once said, well, the fate of Germany will be decided on the River Rhine, not the River Vistula. And I think that's actually quite a good comment. And that sums it up quite nicely. And the interesting thing is that even right into the Second World War, the Germans were not too sure that they could defeat the French. And you just have to look at the development of the German plan of invasion in France in 1940. The initial plans were basically very, very uninspired, a bit like the Schlieffen plan of the First World War. And when you look at, for example, Manstein's memoirs and his writings, he heavily criticizes that and says, well, it's obvious what's going on here. Well, the generals are not brave enough to go for the big solution, as he calls it. And he accuses them of, if you want to call it accuse it, of being overly cautious and just getting into Belgium. And quite a few generals then expected another, trench war like in the First World War. But this time, of course, it would be a bit better for the Germans, because they were not facing a two-front war, because they had a treaty with the Soviet Union. So that probably did help.
It's interesting. One of the questions that I think your book begs, it regards French policy, because, of course, at a certain level, this German debate seems to be happening in a vacuum. But of course, the French are out there. What were the French really intending to do? We have this conception that the French were just going to sit behind the Maginot Line, but I think the Germans are assuming a kind of offensiveness to French strategy that maybe wasn't there. What do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that's also an interesting point, because all these debates and all this thinking, as you point out, seem to have been a bit of a vacuum. And I think that's a fair comment. The Germans were utterly convinced that whatever happened, the French would get involved in the war. The French actually had made a few statements even before the peace treaty had been signed. There were a few things that were happening in the east, and the Germans actually tried to push the, you might say at that stage there were still Polish insurgents, if you want to use that term, out of the province of Posen. And the French then sent a note and said, well, stop that immediately, otherwise we will invade in the west and we will renew the war. So that was kind of, the framework the Germans always worked in right to, the outbreak of the Second World War, you might say. It is, of course, true that in France itself, the desire to go to war was not really that much there. So maybe, to a certain degree, the Germans were perhaps a bit paranoid about the whole thing. On the other hand, I think we can't really blame them for that. And when you look at the French reactions, the French comments, what the French wanted to achieve in the Treaty of Versailles, I can understand why the Germans thought that would always be happening. Of course, then it turns out completely different in 1939, because as you exactly point out, the French sit behind the Maginot Line, and that's where they stay. But let's not forget that the Maginot Line is only built, really in the 1930s. Before that, the French and basically British and New Zealand and American forces have occupied German territory. And it would be very, very easy for them to march into Germany, as indeed they did in 1923.
Exactly. I mean, that's the answer right there. I think you mentioned the scars of the inflation, but also the scars of the occupation, I think, leave a powerful legacy.
So maybe the Germans kind of lost track of what was really going on in France, but they really, really thought that if war breaks out on whatever front, it doesn't matter, even if it was against, I don't know, a state like Denmark. There's one war game where they might play through a war against Denmark. You might ask yourself the question, why against Denmark? Well, it's just one of these things they do. And so they're doing not that badly, but then, of course, after 2 weeks, the French come in, and that's the end of the war game. And so that was always the biggest fear for the Germans. And yes, well, they had experienced it in the 1920s, and even though they were then hiding behind the Maginot Line, the Germans still thought that if a proper big war broke out, the French will invade. And you might argue that that's exactly what the French should have done in 1939. Also, if the French and perhaps even the British had invaded Western Germany, while about 80% of the German army was engaged in defeating the Polish, and they occupied the Rhineland, the German war machine runs dry within 2 weeks' time, and that's the end of the Second World War. And that was really the thing the Germans were very, very worried about. So it's not really so much about, I don't know, the French occupying some southern territories like, I don't know, getting your hands on Stuttgart or any place down there, because that's not really crucial. They were always very, very concerned about the Ruhr area. And it's not that far away from the French or the Dutch and Belgian borders. It's only about a 2 hours drive, and you're there. So they were very, very worried about that.
Well, thanks for your time, Matthias. It's been fascinating to talk to you. It's a great book. It's an important challenge, I think, to some of the conceptions that we have about the development of German military thinking and practice. And I hope it acquires a large readership. I always like to ask authors what their next project is, what they're working on now. Is it something that's related, or are you going in a different direction?
It's partly related. When I did the research for this book, as I said, the whole thing started off as a project in the Second World War. Then I moved back into the interwar period, and when I decided to do this interwar period book, I then thought that I need to go further back in history and to look at what actually happened in the First World War. So there's one chapter in the book on the development of the defensive battle in the First World War. And this is what I'm doing now. So I'm looking in much more detail at the German army in the First World War now. And I've chosen a German regiment, and I'm following that regiment through and see how this regiment applied doctrine, how they coped with new situations, new challenges on the front line, and how basically the conduct of the defensive battle developed for the German army in the First World War. And the regiment I've chosen is the 73rd Fusilier Regiment from Hanover. When you do research on the German army in the First World War, it's always a bit problematic, because an awful lot of sources were destroyed by a British bomber raid on Potsdam, where the army archives were held in 1945. That means that looking at Prussian army units in the First World War is very, very complicated. It's much easier for Bavarian army units or Saxon army units or units from Württemberg, because, well, these archives are still there. And it's another thing that's relatively often overlooked. Up to 2021, when we have the Reichswehr, we don't have a united German army or one German army. The German army is an army of contingents. So you have a Prussian army, a Bavarian army, a Saxon army, and a Württemberg army. So that's just on the sideline. So that's what I'm looking at. And I've chosen that regiment quite deliberately because, first of all, it serves on the Western Front for 4 years. So you get this continuity there. And most of the time it actually fights against British and Commonwealth units. And that, of course, rather selfish reason, makes it easier for me to do the research.
I could see that coming.
Sandhurst is only about half an hour's drive from the National Archives away. So it's relatively easy to look to dip into the British sources and then also look at what the other side did and what they thought about the German performance in the war. And the last reason why I went for that regiment is because it is Ernst Jünger's regiment.
Oh, nice.
And so basically, first of all, it makes the whole thing in itself more attractive because, well, you've got this this very important writer, probably the most important German writer of the First World War, and also helps, at least to a certain degree, to overcome the source problem. Simply because, well, he wrote his books, like Storm of Steel and a few others, and he also left his diary that, well, the diaries have now been published, at least in German. So all this makes it a bit easier and a bit more accessible. And that's the reason why I went for that regiment. So, yeah, I'm done with the research, more or less, at least in the German archives. I finished that, so I'm hoping to get cracking with that within the next few weeks, really.
Terrific. I also like to impose on my interviews to ask them what book I should read next. Is there something that's come out in the last year that that should be on New Books in Military History?
Well, the one I would recommend, but it doesn't really help you because you can't interview the author anymore, actually is Ernst Jünger's diary. But it would be a bit tricky to interview him, really, to be perfectly honest. That probably would not quite work. Another one that has been quite influential, it's been out for a while now, so I'm not quite sure if you've already done an interview or have some sort of feedback on that. It's Alexander Watson. It's a book called... It was published in the Cambridge series, and it is about combat effectiveness in the First World War. And he looks at basically more or less the morale in the German and the British armies, and the collapse of morale in the German army towards 1918. This, at least over here in Britain, has been quite controversial. Because in Britain we have this school of people who think that there was this learning curve, that the British Army went on this learning curve, and by 1918 it came out as the best army in the world. I have always challenged that, and the problem with this learning curve is that it sounds very convincing as long as you don't read any German sources. The moment you read one German source, it's slightly different, because well, most of the sources I've come across say that the British Army on the tactical level, so let's say up to perhaps battalion level in that instance, was very, very good. Everything above that was not that good, and they particularly had leadership issues. And the German intelligence reports and after-action reports state that right through the entire war, right to the last day of the war. And I shouldn't be saying that working for the British Army, but what the Germans actually do think is that the French Army is far superior to the British Army. And you see that right to the end of the war. And the reason why the British Army is so successful in the famous 100 days is basically because at that stage the German Army is not the army of 1914, 15, 16, 17 anymore. The German Army has been defeated in the field. There are so many reports from company commanders where they say, well, when we went out we had 160, 180 men. We're now down to 20 and 10 of them are down with the flu. And basically that really is the important issue. And of course that also then had a big impact on the morale of the German troops, and that's what Alexander Watson looks at. And as I said, it's been, at least over here, very controversial, but I think it's a very good book, and it can be recommended. And particularly, well, if you're able to read German sources, you will see that, well, yes, his arguments do hold water. And he's one of the relatively few Brits who work on the First World War who actually use German sources. You don't get that very often. So,
well, that lets me put on my dissertation supervisor hat for this final moment and to plug language training. It's one thing I'm always trying to stress to my students that you know, the ability in military history to look on the other side of the hill, you know, to access Japanese sources if you're working on the Pacific War or something like that, just is absolutely indispensable. So thanks for discussing your book with us, and thanks for allowing me to make that important pedagogical point as well. And I'll look forward to this book. I'm reading plenty on the First World War, so I'll look forward to this one on the Hanover Regiment. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You've just heard my interview with Matthias Strohn, the author of The German Army and the Defense of the Reich, Military Doctrine and the Conduct of Defensive Battle, 1918 to 1939, published by Cambridge University Press in 2011. Thanks for listening.